Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info. The Torah section Miketz is a passion play of the Mashiach who was to come. Miketz means from the end. It covers Genesis chapters 41 through 43 and up to verse 17 of chapter 44. In the following discussion led by Hallel Fellowship teacher Daniel, we will discover how Yitzhak was a messianic figure, showing us that Mashiach was supposed to die and that that death would bring freedom. Yosef as a messianic figure shows us that Mashiach would rule and reign after he died and was released from death. The suffering that Yosef puts his brothers through wasn't just a recollection of Yosef's own sufferings. It was also a foreshadowing of the suffering of Yeshua, the Anointed One.
Chapter 40, verse 9. It happened at the end of 2 years to the day Pharaoh was dreaming that behold, he was standing on the river, when behold, out of the river there emerged 7 cows of beautiful appearance and robust flesh, and they were grazing in the marshland. Then behold, 7 other cows emerged after them out of the river, of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh, and they stood next to the cows on the bank of the river. The cows of ugly appearance and gaunt flesh ate the 7 cows of beautiful appearance and robust. And Pharaoh awoke. He fell and dreamt a second time, and behold, 7 ears of grain were sprouting on a single stalk, healthy and good. And behold, 7 ears, thin and scorched by the east wind, were growing after them. Then the thin ears swelled the 7 healthy, full ears. Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it had been a dream. It was in the morning his spirit was agitated, so he sent and summoned all the necromancers of Egypt and all his wise men. Pharaoh related his dream to them, but none could interpret them for Pharaoh. Then the chamberlain of the cupbearer spoke up before Pharaoh, saying, "My transgressions do I mention today." Pharaoh had become incensed at his servants and placed me in the ward of the house of the chamberlain of the butchers. Me and the chamberlain of the bakers. We dreamt a dream on the same night. I and he, each one according to the interpretation of his dream, did we dream. And there with us was a Hebrew youth, a slave of the chamberlain of butchers. We related it to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us, and he interpreted it for each in accordance with his dream. And it was that just as he interpreted for us, so did it happen. He restored me to my post, and him he hanged. So Pharaoh sent and summoned Joseph, and they rushed him from the dungeon. He shaved and changed his clothes, and he came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I dreamt a dream, but no one can interpret it. Now I heard it of you that you can comprehend a dream to interpret it." Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, That is beyond me. It is God who will respond with Pharaoh's welfare. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "In my dream, behold, I was standing upon the bank of the river, and behold, out of the river there emerged 7 cows of robust flesh and beautiful form, and they were grazing in the marshland. Suddenly 7 other cows emerged from them, scrawny and of very inferior form and of emaciated flesh. I have never seen inferiority like theirs in all the land of Egypt." And the emaciated and inferior cows ate up the 7 healthy cows. They came inside them, but it was not apparent that they had come inside them, for their appearance remained as inferior as at first. Then I awoke, and I saw in my dream, behold, 7 ears of grain were sprouting on a single stalk, full and good. And suddenly 7 ears of grain withered, thin and scorched by the east wind, were growing after them. Then the thin ears of grain swallowed up the 7 good ears. And I said this to the necromancers, but no one could explain it to me. Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dream of Pharaoh is a single one. What God is about to do, he has told Pharaoh. The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good years are seven years. It is a single dream. Now the 7 emaciated cows who emerged after them, they were 7 years, as the 7 emaciated ears scorched by the east wind. There shall be 7 years of famine. It is this matter that I have spoken to Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he has shown to Pharaoh. Behold, 7 years are coming, a great abundance throughout all the land of Egypt. The 7 years of famine will arise after them, and all the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. The famine will ravage the land, and the abundance will be unknown. In the land, in the face of the subsequent famine, for it will be terribly severe. As for the repetition of the dream to Pharaoh, 2 times it is because the matter stands ready before God, and God is hastening to accomplish it. Now let Pharaoh seek out a discerning and wise man and set him over the land in Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed and let him appoint overseers on the land, and he shall prepare the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. And let them gather all the food of those approaching good years. Let them amass grain under Pharaoh's authority for food in the cities and safeguard it. The food will be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine which will befall the land of Egypt, so that the land will not perish in the famine. The matter appeared good in Pharaoh's eyes and in the eyes of all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Could we find another like him, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed of you of all this, there can be no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and by your command shall all my people be sustained. Only by the throne shall I outrank you." Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have placed you in charge of all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh removed his ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. Then he had him dressed in garments and of fine linen, and he placed a gold chain upon his neck. He also had him ride in his second chariot. They proclaimed before him, "Avarech." Thus he appointed him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without you, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh called Joseph's names Zaphnath-Paneah, and gave him an Asenath, daughter of Potiphar, Pharaoh, chief of On, for a wife. Thus Joseph emerged in charge of the land of Egypt. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Joseph left Pharaoh's presence, and he passed through the entire land of Egypt. The earth produced during the 7 years of abundance by the handfuls. He gathered all food for the 7 years that had come to pass in the land of Egypt, and he placed food in the cities. The food of the field around each city he placed within it. Joseph amassed grain like the sand of the sea in great abundance, now until he ceased counting, for there was no number. Now to Joseph were born 2 sons, when the year of famine had not yet set in, whom Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, chief of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the first Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my hardship in all my father's household. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made him fruitful in the land of my suffering. The 7 years of abundance that came to pass in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began approaching, just as Joseph had said. There was a famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. For when all the land of Egypt hungered, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. So Pharaoh said to all of Egypt, "Go to Joseph, whatever he tells you, you should do." When the famine spread over all the face of the earth, Joseph opened up all the containers and sold provisions to Egypt, and the famine became so severe in the land of Egypt, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy provisions, for the famine had become severe in all the earth. Chapter 42. Jacob perceived that there were provisions in Egypt, so Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you make yourselves conspicuous?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there are provisions in Egypt. Go down there and purchase for us from there, that we may live and not die." So Joseph's brothers, 10 of them, went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob, did not send along with his brothers, for he said, "Lest disaster befall him." So the sons of Israel came to buy provisions among the rivals, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph, he was a viceroy over the land. He was a provider to all the people of the land. Joseph's brothers came and they bowed to him, faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and he recognized them, but he acted like a stranger toward them and spoke with them harshly. He asked them, "From where have you come?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Joseph called the dreams that recalled the dreams that he had dreamed about them. So he said to them, "You are spies, and to see the land's nakedness have you come?" They answered him, "Not so, my lord, for your servants have come to buy food. All of us, sons of one man, are we. We are truthful people. Your servants have never been spies." And he said to them, "No, but the land's nakedness have you come to see?" And they replied, "We are your servants, our twelve brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with their father, and one is gone." But Joseph said to them, "It is just as I have declared to you, saying, 'You are spies,' but this shall you be tested. By Pharaoh's life, you will not leave here unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him fetch your brother while you shall remain in prison, so that your words may be tested whether the truth is with you. But if not, by Pharaoh's life, surely you are spies. Then he herded them into a ward for a 3-day period. Joseph said to them on the third day, "Do this and live, I fear God. If you are truthful people, let one of your brothers be imprisoned in your place of confinement while you go and bring provisions for the hunger of your households. Then bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you will not die." They did so. They then said to one another, "Indeed, we are guilty concerning our brother, inasmuch as we saw his heartfelt anguish when he pleaded with us, and we paid no heed. That is why this anguish has come upon us." Reuben spoke up against them, saying, "Did I not speak to you, saying, 'Do not sin against the boy,' but you would not listen. And his blood as well, behold, is being avenged." Now they did not know that Joseph understood, for an interpreter was between them. He turned away from them and wept. He returned to them and spoke to them. He took Simeon from them and imprisoned him before their eyes. Joseph commanded that they fill their vessels with grain and to return their money, each one to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. And so he did for them. Then they loaded their purchase onto their donkeys and departed from there. When the one of them opened his sack to feed his donkey at the inn, he saw his money, and behold, it was in the mouth of the sack. So he said to his brothers, "My money has been returned, and behold, it too is in my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" They came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan. They told him of all that happened to them, saying, The Lord of the land spoke harshly to us and considered us as if we were spying out the land. But we said to him, "We are truthful men, we have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is gone, and the youngest is now with her father in the land of Canaan." Then the man, the Lord of the land, said to us, "By this I will ascertain whether you are truthful people. One of your brothers leave with me, and what is needed for the hunger of your households, take and go. And bring your youngest brother to me, so I will know that you are not spies, but truthful people. I will restore with your brother to you, and you will go, and you will be free to circulate about the land." Then as they were emptying their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in a sack. When they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were terrified. Then their father Jacob said to them, "I am the one whom you bereaved. Joseph is gone, Simeon is gone, and now you would take away Benjamin. Upon me has it all fallen." But Reuben told his father, saying, "You may slay my two sons if I fail to bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is alone left. Disaster befall him on the journey which you shall take, then you shall have brought down my hoariness and sorrow to the grave." Chapter 43. The famine was severe in the land. When they had finished eating the provisions which they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back, buy some food." But Judah told him, saying, The man sternly warned us, saying, "Do not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you are ready to send your brothers with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you do not send, we will not go down." For the man said to us, "Do not see my face unless your brother is with you." Then Israel said, "Why did you treat me so ill by telling the man that you had another brother?" And they said, "The man persistently asked about us and our relatives, saying, 'Is your father still alive? Have you a brother?' And responded to him according to these words. Could we possibly have known that he would say, 'Bring your brother down'?" Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the land with me, and let us arise and go, so we will live and not die. We as well as our children. One more time. Send the land with me, and let us arise and go, so we will live and not die. We as well as our children. I will personally guarantee him if of my own hand you can demand him. If I do not bring him back to you and stand him before you, then I will have sinned to you for all time. For we had not delayed. By now we could have returned twice." Israel, their father, said to them, "It must be so. Then do this. Take of the land's glory in your baggage and bring it down to the man as a tribute, a bit of balsam, a bit of honey, wax, lotus, pistachios, and almonds, and take with you double the money, and the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks, return in your hands. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother and arise, return to the man, and may El Shaddai grant you mercy before the man that he released to you your other brother, as well as Benjamin. And as for me, I have bereaved, so I am bereaved." So the man took his tribute, and they took double money in their hand, as well as Benjamin. They set out and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. Joseph saw Benjamin with them, so he said to the one in the charge of his house, "Bring the men to the house, have meat slaughtered and prepare it, for with me will these men dine at noon." The man did as Joseph said, and the man brought the men to Joseph's house. But the men became frightened when they were brought to Joseph's house. They said, "Because of the money replaced in our sacks originally, are we being brought so that a charge can be fabricated against us, that it crash down on us, and that we be taken as slaves along with our donkeys?" They approached the man who was in charge of Joseph and Joseph's house and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. And they said, "If you please, my lord, we have indeed come down originally to buy food, but it happened when we arrived at the inn and opened our sacks that, behold, each one's money was in the mouth of his sack, and it was our money in its full amount. So we have brought it back to our land, in our hand. We have also brought our other money down in our hand to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks." He replied, "Peace with you. Fear not. Your God and the God of your father has put a hidden treasure in your sacks. Your payment has reached me, and he brought Shimon out to them." Then the man brought the men to Joseph's house. He provided water, and they washed their feet, and he gave feed to the donkeys. They prepared the tribute for when Joseph would come at noon, for they heard that they were to eat a meal there. Then Joseph came to the house. They brought the tribute that was in their hand to him to the house, and they prostrated themselves to him toward the ground. He inquired after their welfare, and said, "Is your aged father of whom you spoke at peace? Is he still alive?" They replied, "Your servant, our father, is at peace. He still lives." And they said, they bowed and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. So he said, "This is your little brother of whom you spoke to me?" He said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Joseph rushed because his compassion for his brother had been stirred and he wanted to weep. So he went into the room and wept there. He washed his face and went out, fortified himself, and said, "Serve food." They served him separately and them separately, and the Egyptians who ate with him separately, for the Egyptians could not bear to eat food with the Hebrews, it being loathsome to Egyptians. They were seated before him, the firstborn according to his seniority, and the youngest according to his youth. The men looked at one another in astonishment. had portions that had been set before him served. He had portions that had been set before him served to them, and Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as the portion of any of them. They drank and became intoxicated with him. Chapter 44. Then he instructed the one in charge of his house, saying, "Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and my goblet, silver goblet, place it in the mouth of the youngest one's sack, according place in the mouth of the youngest one's sack along with the money of his purchase." And he followed Joseph's word exactly. The day dawned and the men were set off, they and their donkeys. They had left the city, had not gone far, when Joseph said to the one in charge of his house, "Get up and chase after the men. When you overtake them, you are to say to them, 'Why do you repay good for evil? Is this not the one from which my master drinks, and with which he regularly divines? You have done evil in how you acted.' He overtook them and spoke those words to them. And they said to him, 'Why does my lord say such things? It would be sacrilegious for your servants to do such a thing. Here, look, the money that we found in the mouth of your sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we have stolen your master's house, any silver or gold? Anyone among your servants with whom it is found shall die, and we will also become slaves to my lord.' He replied, 'What you say now is also correct. The one with whom it is found shall be my slave, and the rest of you shall be exonerated.' Hurriedly, each one lowered his sack to the ground, and each one opened his sack. He searched. He began with the oldest and ended with the youngest. And the goblet was found in Benjamin's sack. They rent their garments, each one loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. When Judah arrived with his brothers to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, "What is this deed that you have done? Do you not realize that a man like me practices divination?" So Judah said, "What can we say to my lord? How can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has uncovered the sins of your servants. Here we are. We are ready to be slaves to my lord, both we and the one in whose hand the goblet was found." But he replied, "It would be sacrilegious for me to do this. The man in whose possession the goblet was found, only he shall be my slave. As for you, go up in peace to your father." Thus ending the Cates. Any questions for Daniel?
Thanks.
I just put it on. Yeah. Yes, wise choice.
Thank you, Jared. Mazel tov for your effort. So regarding this section, well, are there any questions? Comments, things got your attention that he went through, that Jared was able to read to you? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess we're going from the end to the beginning here, but I noticed when the goblet was found in Benjamin's sack, but right before that, they speak up and they say, with whomever of your servants, they don't even know yet.
Right, they have no idea.
No idea. And so somebody pipes up and says, "With whomever your servants it is found, let him die, and we will also be my lord's slaves." But then the servant replies and says, "Now let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, but the rest of you shall be innocent." But the thing is that they committed the same mistake that Jacob did when he cursed the person who stole the idols to death without even knowing who had done it or why.
Right.
And so it's like this repeating itself. They're cursing somebody to death without knowing why.
It's a unique, not unique. I guess it's maybe a family trait. I don't know. Prejudging something before you even know all the facts. It is an issue, and we're all grateful that obviously it turned out well for each of them. In this instance, yeah. The brothers' response I thought was interesting, that because they have no idea what was taken. Now, we know in the story, Joseph says, "Hey, tell the servant, it's my silver cup, you shall be in the sack." Well, the brothers have no idea what's taken. They say, "Why would it take silver or gold?" They don't know it's a cup. They don't know if it's silver at all. They assume it's some monetary value of gold or silver. At the same time, they even argued, hey, we brought our money back to us in our hand to hand it to you, much less, you know, why would we then take something from you at the same time? It's an absurd argument. And that, of course, was the point that they were trying to make. That of course, you wouldn't do such a thing. But naturally, of course, they have no idea all the details of what's happening. So, maquettes. Well, so we just read, it was, that was from Genesis 41, verse 1 through 44, verse 17. Now, at this time in the storyline, Joseph is roughly 32-ish or so, roughly 31, 32 years old, Joseph. He's approximately 32. He may be near, I don't know his exact birth date. Doesn't make much difference. And at this time, Jacob is about 120 years old, and Isaac is about 180. So Isaac is dying at about the time this story is taking place. Because Isaac dies at 180. At this time in the story, when Joseph's being brought up, he's not quite 32 yet. He's being brought up first, the first part of the story is 32, when he goes to before Pharaoh. He's still 30. He goes to Pharaoh. 32 when the boys come. So 30 years old. So Joseph, is being brought out of prison at the time which Isaac is just dying of old age. Isaac, of course, assumes Joseph is dead because he, of course, doesn't hear about his life or what happens to him, at that time. There's probably some reasons or symbolic reasons to why Isaac is dying at the same time Joseph is being saved. Anybody thinking any one of the reasons why? Any ideas? Who did Isaac represent? At various times, it was a Messiah. It was a messianic figure. But there was a specific thing about Isaac because Isaac was a special type of person. He was offered. Not actually truly offered, but he was supposed to be, quote, sacrificed symbolically by Abraham. It was offered. But in the rule of his offering, from that point forward, he was never to leave Israel, the territory of Canaan. So he was confined to stay there. So Isaac was confined. He was confined to live in that territory. He was told, both Abraham had told his chief servant, don't take Isaac back to find a wife. And when Isaac was ill or anytime there was a famine, God told him, do not leave this land. You were to stay here at this time. So Isaac's confined his whole life to be in that territory. He never leaves it. But at that time, which he becomes unconfined, meaning he dies, Joseph releases his confinement. So when Isaac dies, an offering is then accepted, meaning he's passed on by God. He's receiving him. At the same time, Joseph gets free. It's a symbolic tie between those two men. So God is taking Joseph's imprisonment, so he's a pit or prison. And at that time which God chooses, this is the moment in time which this will happen. God's saying, this is the time which you will get free and I will accept the offering. So what does it tell us? Well, Isaac is a messianic figure. So in his symbolic death, which he didn't actually die, but he was almost offered by Abraham, he becomes a messianic figure that, as if Messiah is supposed to die, to be killed. And that was the symbolism behind it. As if Messiah is supposed to die. And as a result, the blessings come to Abraham. Well, this symbolism, this tie-in, shows us that when Isaac truly dies, freedom is granted. Which means when Messiah truly dies, freedom is granted. It's a tie-in of the symbols. The Bible, the Torah in particular, is heavy with these because they want to get the picture of death of somebody who's honorable means release from somebody else who should be released. That's how the symbolism is supposed to continuously work. And it's repeated over and over again. So this event is not timed randomly. God chose this moment in time to give Pharaoh the dreams so that Isaac will get out, or so Joseph will get out at the time which Isaac is dying. Make sense? So the timing is important. God is not one who arbitrarily chooses at times. Yes, Jared.
Why was it an abomination for the Egyptians to eat with the Hebrews?
That's a great question. And I only have part of the answer, so I can't answer completely. Part of the answer is broken up into two things. His question was, why is it an abomination for the Egyptians to eat food or eat meals with the Hebrews? And so there are two parts to it, but I don't have the complete picture, so I can't answer it all the way. But I'll do what I can. So, I'll change colors because it's blue. In Egyptian rules, Egyptian law, there was the Egyptian class of people, which is, well, we'll call it Egyptians. Now, this rule applies to Egyptians who are free, meaning they're not slaves, they're not... they're not slaves. But bottom line, these are free men. Free men. Egyptians are free men. So Egyptians who are free. It is an abomination for a free man in Egyptian society to ever eat food with a servant or a slave. Now, Joseph was a slave in that he was purchased by Potiphar, and he was put in prison. So he's a slave and a criminal as far as Egyptian life is concerned. And in Egyptian rules, Egyptian law at the time still, I don't know if it was today, but it was, for many years, that once you were a slave at one point in life, or a criminal at one point in life, you were that way until you die. It's not a, oh, well, you're forgiven, doesn't matter. No, it's you, once you have become a slave, there is no such thing as freedom after slavery. You've been a slave at once, you were a slave forever now. Makes a difference. Even though you may do something else later on, you may buy your own freedom, that's meaningless. A slave is a slave forever. So, as a result, the Egyptian rules, if you're free, you don't eat with slaves. That also applies to criminals, which, of course, Joseph was both a slave and a criminal. Well, criminal's loose, because he was falsely accused, but same difference. So, a criminal. Both those are not acceptable. Now, that's the case whether or not they're Hebrew or anybody else makes no difference. A slave and a criminal is not to be eaten. You don't share a meal with them. They're considered untrustworthy. They're unclean to the Egyptian society. That's part of the answer, because both Joseph was that case. Even though he became really important, that made a difference. You don't eat with him. It's still not acceptable because he was once that. The other part is a little bit sketchier for me, in that Egyptian society treated foreigners as them foreigners. They don't belong here. They're not part of us. They're not part of our bloodline. So in Egyptian society at the time was also treated with foreigners, in this case Hebrews in general, that people. I'll write it down. Hebrews. As a non-Egyptian, so you are of a lower class. Now, that didn't necessarily apply to only Hebrews. It applied to all foreigners in general. Now, the Hebrews in particular had a special grouping of Hebrews, in that this particular group happened to be shepherds and nomadic type of tribes. So we'll call them shepherds. I'll just abbreviate, and nomads. So both shepherds and nomads are also disdained in Egyptian society at the time, whether you're Hebrew or not. The reason why shepherds and nomads were disdained is because in Egyptian society, look at their culture. What were they known for? Can you think of the only thing of Egypt that anybody ever knows? The massive civilization, the massive pyramids they built. They're very big on of civilization and cultivating and taming what is wild to make it bend to your or to man's will. Well, shepherds and nomads don't. They're the opposite. They bend and move to whatever the world around them follows. And Egyptians did not respect that at the time. These are the only two answers that I happen to know or have heard of or understand. There may be more, but that's all I understand. Yes?
Could it possibly also be that the Egyptians held the cattle as a god?
They had a lot of gods,
And they perhaps didn't eat cattle meat.
That's true. They did have an issue with animals in general because Moses points that out later, that if because Pharaoh offers to Moses, hey, do your sacrifices here in the land, and Moses, we can't because it's an abomination to the Egyptians because they worship these things, we're going to go kill. So at that time, at Moses' time, clearly they still worshipped or were honorable of animals, which is probably why this whole disrespect of shepherds came from, or is attached to. And that Because when Joseph brings his father in the next section, I think it is, that he tells his sons, Joseph's brothers, tell Pharaoh, tell that you are shepherds. And because some of you are shepherds, you will get applied to the land of Goshen territory. It identifies what your function is. And if there's anything good about you, you'll tend Pharaoh's flocks, but it isolates them on purpose. It wasn't just an arbitrary, hey, this happened to do for a living. Joseph told them specifically, you make sure you say just this word this way so that you'll get the response I'm trying to get from him. And so clearly there's an issue with shepherd or animal tending. Even though Egyptians did have animals, they didn't like the practice, I guess. I'm not sure what the details are. And besides that, Hebrews also don't shave. They don't like hair. Egyptians don't like hair. Yes, go ahead.
Well, another thing would be like the Egyptians don't like the Hebrews because their ancestor tricked their king into with the whole Abraham and Sarah, she's my sister, don't kill me episode.
You know, you could. The term Hebrew, that depends, because most people have associated the term Hebrew as wanderer, or one who just wanders or wanders around. But it also comes the word Eber, which is the ancestor of Abraham, a man in generations prior. And that some of his descendants of Eber are called Hebrews or Hebrews. I don't know if the Egyptians would recognize that the ancestor of Abraham is Eber, and therefore all of you are Hebrews, as opposed to in blaming, at the same time trying to associate that term with Abraham's conduct. If I was to do that, I would call them Abrahamites, because, oh, they're from that family, if that was the case. But I don't know. It could be that there's some association they specifically don't like. On top of this event in Hebrews, look where they came from, where they were coming from the land of Canaan. Egypt and Canaan, for many years, have not liked each other. They've gone back and forth in battles before this and after this many, many times, and they continuously fight and fight and fight. And so the likelihood that the Hebrews, because it came to the territory also, it just may not have liked them just because of where they came from, could be also a contributor in this whole story, as far as why they don't want to sit with them. Yes, David.
It seems to me that perhaps this Torah portion and next week's is something that could be taught on for several weeks on end, because there's so much going on there. And
it's a lot.
Last week or the week before, I'm not sure which, but you were talking about how a story starts in parallel, you know,
oh, right.
And it comes together and it points
right.
to something in the
middle.
In the middle. And, you know, with the parallels of Jacob and Laban, the things that went on there and what's going on the same in this story, the parallels there are absolutely, you know, amazing. But, you know, just reading through it, when Lisa and I were doing it, it was really amazing to me how Joseph, you know, it starts out with him in the dream telling his brothers, they hate him because he's telling them, you're going to all bow down before me.
Right.
And then fast forward, here comes some of them to right. bow down before him. And then he says he remembers his dream,
mm-hmm.
knows who they are, but they're not all here.
Right.
And so he cleverly deceives them
uh-huh.
because his end goal is not only to make them realize that he truly knew, you know, when it was prophesizing truth, but as a way of punishment to get them to understand that you truly are bowing down before me.
All of them.
All of them.
All of them. Including Benjamin.
And so there's a lot of things, trickery going on there.
It is.
Where he wants everybody there to bow down before him. And it's unique how Benjamin is from his same mother. That's his cherished little brother, and he almost blows the whole thing with him. And he's all like, you guys can all go, but I'm keeping my beloved true
uh-huh.
brother,
uh-huh.
you know, by the same mother.
Yep.
And, but yet, as we move forward, the whole thing, you know, as we know the story, comes together, and behold, there they all are bowing down before
yeah.
the one that they hated him for that, and now they love him for this.
uh-huh. That is the quintessential storyline for Joseph and why he is the messianic figure known for. That's what he's known for. He is playing Messiah's role throughout this entire storyline. It's literally the people of Israel, Jacob, bowing down to Messiah. They have to come to him and bow down to him. He's going to make sure every single one of them, not one's lost, in the process of making this happen. That's part of the storyline. It's part of how the parallel works today in this story. We're going to talk about a bit today. He is a huge messianic figure because he portrays and fills out most of Messiah's life. In this part of it, in his relationship with his own people. Yes.
Well, this right here shows you that, you know, people wondered, you know, and it's even an argument between Jews and Christians to this day of what Messiah does and when he does it.
Right.
You know, well, this shows you that he was supposed to die and be resurrected first and then rule.
Yep.
Then not the ruler. Other way around. Yeah. Rule first and then somehow be die and resurrected, which is probably what most Jews believe, that he'll reign first and then maybe he might die sometime and might not.
Right.
But this is proof right here that the Messiah has to be offered,
mm-hmm.
he has to die, and he has to somehow be released from death,
yep.
and then he reigns.
That's exactly right.
So, we have it right here.
It shows you the
gospel is right here.
It's you right here.
Yeah.
Yep. The gospel is pretty evident on how it's repeated over and over again. It's just different. It's just perspective on how you're looking at it. It's supposed to be that way. Yes.
The story I know, I always look at that deep level, is that Joseph is Egyptian. He does all the customs of the, you know, and look at the Christ of today.
Yes.
The Christ of today is Santa Claus, Christmas, all the days that are all attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he never told his brothers who he was. So to me, that's another facet of the story, is that he dresses like an Egyptian, looks like everything he does. And he never revealed himself yet. So, I mean, that's happening to the Jewish people still today.
It has been happening.
They have not recognized. Well, of course they haven't, because it's understandable. But it's just amazing how all this ties in. You see that, you know, it was his suffering. And I'll have to look closer to my notes.
That's okay.
This story is so, like you said, it's going to take so long to unravel.
There's a lot
it's so
here.
Intricate. It's
There's
so
a lot here. And I'm condensing this part because we're doing a play later on today.
Oh.
So we're doing a Hanukkah play. I'm going to call this quits about 15 minutes. We're going to fly through this quickly. You're going to be the king? All right. You can be King Antiochus at Hanukkah play. Sidebar. All right. Any question? We'll fly through this. I'll try not to miss it too much, but I'm going to get as many as I can that's important points. All right. Deep breath. All right, we can do this. First of all, in verse 40, or chapter 21, in the storyline, as Joseph is being introduced verbally before he actually physically meets Pharaoh, he is described in a couple of different terms by the cup bearer, the man who takes care of Pharaoh's wine, in that he is a youth, he's a slave or a prisoner. basically disparaging remarks, and that he's cited as a Hebrew, a slave, and a youth. These are all designed to give the cupbearer strength in knowing that Pharaoh may say, I'm going to listen to this guy, he's a nobody. And the cupbearer's pointing out, yeah, he's a nobody, so I don't want to stick my own neck out too far and say how great this kid is, because realistically, you almost had me whacked a couple years ago, so I'm not going to try to remind you of how great a person that he is or I am, because this is not such a good idea. But anyhow, obviously Joseph is brought up. He has to show himself, so he's brought up out of the pit or out of the grave, so to speak, which is the whole point of how I mentioned earlier with Isaac's death and Joseph's rising up. It matches the symbolism between Isaac, the offering of Isaac, the offering of Messiah, of course, raising up then of Joseph, the freedom. And of course, as a result, with Joseph's raised up, he of course discloses to Pharaoh his dream, and he's then elevated up to second in command, the right hand of Pharaoh, which all then matches Messiah's storyline. So when he dies, he's raised up to heaven, sits at the right hand of God. It's all consistent with how the symbol of Joseph and the symbol of Messiah are tied together. So everything was given, of course, verse 44 of chapter 41. All that was given to Joseph, except Pharaoh's throne. So everything else Pharaoh turned over to him, except his own personal throne. Only in the throne alone is Pharaoh greater. Which again matches Messiah in his relationship with God, the Father. So Messiah is second only to God himself and only in the throne. All other power, all authority is handed over to him as it's all yours. You're running it. So Joseph and Messiah continuously match their process of how they're going through this. Side note, it's possible that Joseph then marries Potiphar's daughter, but I'm not sure about that. You notice that Potiphar and Potipharah are the same Hebrew words. It has to do with whether you pronounce that ayin at the end or you don't. Potiphar and Potipharah, they could be the same individual, but it's hard to say for certain. But so he gets this wonderful blessing, but Pharaoh gives him a name. I can't pronounce it well, so I'm going to spell it out for you. It's a Zaph. It basically means one who has hidden things have been revealed. That's all it really means. But it matches, again, what Messiah is supposed to be. That which is hidden becomes revealed because he's supposed to reveal himself and what he is supposed to do and what he does. So in this title, even the title itself given to Joseph also, again, ties with Messiah. So we're seeing a bunch of parallels in the storyline trying to tie Joseph and Messiah together again and again and again. There's a reason why. Because that explains where the silver cup comes from. And this divination thing that just confuses a lot of Christian people in general. If we can tie Joseph heavily to being Messiah, the cup that his brother takes or doesn't take, that is planted on him, reveals itself as to what the symbolism is supposed to be. The cup, which we'll get to in a few minutes. The cup meant something. So think about that for a minute. We'll get to there and explain it to you in a little while. So in the storyline as we go through, God blesses Joseph with two sons. That's an E. I misspelled that. With two sons. What were the names? Manasseh. And Ephraim. I spell them various ways. Doesn't make much difference to the Hebrew words. Manasseh and Ephraim. And what do the two sons mean? The names?
Forgetting.
Forget. This Manasseh was forget.
And fruitful.
And this one's fruitful. These are important concepts. The forget and the fruitful.
Jeff, I'm sorry.
That's the one to whom hidden things are revealed. That's what Zephaniah Paneath means. That was that what is hidden is revealed to this person. This person reveals what is hidden. That's what the symbolism is supposed to be. So forgetful and fruitful. And forget what in particular?
The past.
It specifically says his father's house. Forgetful as far as his house, and of course he's fruitful as a result of it. In this concept, the forgetful of the father's house and fruitful of it is an important one in the story of Joseph. Because in this idea of him forgetting and being fruitful where he's at, his new place, it ties into his job as he is the right-hand man of Pharaoh in his tasks. What was Joseph's task after he revealed the story to Pharaoh about what it all means? What job was he given? Joseph's job was to collect food for over and over and over to prepare for what's going to be happening. That's for what Joseph's task was. Now, Joseph's playing Messiah in this role, even the work itself is. So in this story, let's rephrase this slightly. I'm not changing it, I'm just rephrasing it a little differently. So Joseph's playing Messiah and he repeats it over and over and over again. Let's replace some words real quick. So Messiah forgets Jacob house, Jacob's house, and is fruitful. Two L's. And, or multiplies. It's an M. What's Messiah's job when he passed, when he died? What happened? What happened to the story when Messiah died? Who forgot him? Who did he forget? And who was blessed and who was fruitful and multiplied after he died? Look around you. They're all in the room today. Right? You all look around you. Now, when Messiah lived, who rejected him when he was alive? His brothers. The Jews, the people of Judah. When he died, who continued to reject him? His Jews, his brothers. All these are the house of Jacob is rejecting him. But what happened? What was the result? The Gentiles became fruitful and multiplied greatly. Look around you. They're all over the place. So the Gentiles exceedingly grew. At the same time, Jacob's house didn't. Wasn't blessed. Wasn't grew in the same fashion. It stayed in its own house. So it's literally as symbolism behind, because Joseph is experiencing what Messiah experiences as well. And that his own family, Jacob's house, or in Joseph's house, is rejecting or not attached to him at all. But that lack of attachment, God still blesses Messiah in all of his work. And of course, Joseph and all of his work is still fruitful and gains and multiplies, increasingly getting bigger and bigger and bigger. As of course, as a result, Egypt becomes the dominant food supplier for the land for the next following 7 years after he saves everything. So this forgetful process as well as the fruitful process is still also another symbol attached to Messiah in his storyline. So in this consistent repetition, because in this process, something has to happen. Eventually, as happened with Joseph, Jacob's house has to come back to Messiah. Just like in Joseph's life, his father's house, all of his brothers, had to come back to Joseph in order to survive. So we're seeing this separation, the deviation of Jacob's house from Joseph and Messiah, and as well as the increase of the new place, which is the Gentile world. But Egypt is a representation of the Gentile world in almost every circumstance. So this new place is fruitful and multiplied. So Gentiles are fruitful and multiply while Jacob's house suffers and shrinks. See the symbols? See what's going on here? We're being taught through Joseph's story, Messiah's life, even though the story is written thousands of years before. Almost 2,000. Well, 2,000 years before Messiah was even born. Yes, Rose.
I was watching Sid Roth the other night, and he is a Jew who turned to Christ. He's preaching in Jerusalem, in Israel, and hundreds of Jewish people are coming to Messiah.
There are a lot of them.
Hundreds.
Yep. There's a phenomenon that started occurring years ago, but it's been growing significantly.
It gives me goosebumps.
They're coming to a realization on both sides, and that the Gentile side is realizing that God didn't throw away his people, nor did he throw away his commandments, nor did he throw anything away, because as the Bible quotes, God never changes. Ever, 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 ever. He never changes. If he never changes, that means what was right before is still right now. It's still always right, because he never changes. Righteousness is always righteousness. Gentiles are slowly beginning to realize that actually there's some merit to that. At the same time, Jews are realizing that we're not doing so hot. There's something stronger and more important out there that we're missing. So both are slowly working their way together. It's been going for a long time, but it's been slowly increasing as the years have gone by. Yes, Anne?
I know that Joseph was the father of Ephraim and Manasseh, but the children are actually Gentile and Jew, aren't they? I mean, with the Egyptian, and you know, so they were going to be increased. I mean, Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh would be increased, but the other 10 tribes would be.
The 10 tribes have to come to him. When Messiah was alive at the time which he was alive, how many people followed him who once were Jewish or being of that line, a family line, still biologically are, but chose to follow him? Actually, a good portion did. Look at his disciples. All of them did. Their households were, well, I don't know how many kids they have, but they continue on. That process still grew. In that when Joseph is experiencing this, he still has Manasseh, his son, and Ephraim, his son, are with him. So you still have part of Jacob's house there, but it's only a small part as it's growing and being blessed and increases. Eventually, I'm sorry, say that a little louder. It was mostly Jewish, right, because there's no distinction in appearance or like that. Eventually, these two tribes, as we already know the story, Ephraim becomes the most dominant of all the tribes, shy of only Judah himself. So Ephraim becomes the dominant player in the entire storyline of northern Israel. So this blessing of Messiah increases, and of course it does increase Ephraim greatly. Still part of Jacob's house, but all the rest of the house has to come to Messiah to get blessed. Yes, Don?
There's two things. One, if I'm not mistaken, there's about eight rabbis who want to retry Jesus.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah. There's we know some people in Israel. They're trying to. They are rabbis, and they are messianic, at least quietly. And then the other thing is did you happen to hear of Netanyahu's Merry Christmas to Christians?
No, I had not heard.
Get on the internet. You'll be very, very happy about it.
All right. Maybe we will be. Praise of Christianity in general.
He was praising. He said, we want to be friends. He said, I'll be here to meet you personally when you come to Israel. He said, we respect you and we love you.
Let's
say that he went to the whole house before he came.
I'm sorry, say that a little again.
The whole house of Israel. He said, by the when they asked when he came, if you come back, he said, you won't even be the whole house of Israel bringing them back.
I'd have to look at the quote. I mean, you're paraphrasing. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head.
When they said that
return, the house of Zion, the house of Jacob.
Yeah, that he wouldn't have gone to the whole house yet. So.
All the people of the world will not have been brought back yet when he's here. Right, he's the one who's finishing off. Yes, he'll bring them all back all when he gets here. That's part of this whole process of bowing themselves to Messiah. I need to move a little further forward because I'm getting a little further behind, so I apologize. Let's move forward a little bit. Okay. Let's advance this a little bit. So, obviously, as David correctly pointed out, Joseph, of course, has his 10 brothers in front of him, but he's missing one. That's what it says. He recalls his dream that all 11 had to be there. So, he has to concoct a way of getting Benjamin down here. And, of course, this was his concoction. Attempt number one, it's an important attempt, was 3 days in prison. I'm going to erase this because I don't need it right now. Oops. I broke it. It actually broke. I didn't need that. Not that part. Okay, I will do this the other way. There's more than one way to skin a cat, right? Okay. Well, they're fixing that. If they can fix, I don't know if it's possible or not. Figures I'd be too aggressive. Okay, so let's finish. Where was I? I was at... The dream. Okay, that's just the dream. Let's advance forward.
3 days in prison.
3 days in prison. So, all the 10 brothers come down. So, let's see, 10 brothers. He's missing one. What's the solution? 3 days in prison, right? That should tell you something. Anytime you see the number 3, and you have something in a pit, prison, well, grave, it always is a sign of Messiah. So he has 3 days in prison. Is his solution. Why would he do that? Now, I tell you this importantly because Messiah is represented in Joseph, not his brothers. The 10 brothers who are there, not the 11th one isn't there yet. They're not represented Messiah in this story. Joseph is represented Messiah. So why are the 10 brothers experiencing time in prison instead of Joseph? But Joseph already went through that, right? He went through 12 years in prison. So he's already experienced the whole idea of what prison's like. But he chose 3 days in prison for the brothers. I'll explain that in a little while. How long he spent in the well. It may have been a day or multiple days. But it says he was in prison for a number of days, years, as he went through his life cycle. So Joseph experienced the idea of being in prison, of course, getting back out of the pit and asking for assistance, all that kind of good stuff. But this 3 days in prison meant something. It's a sign of Messiah.
Yep, yep. In the end,
sign. A-H, I can spell correctly. It's a sign of Messiah, but it's a sign of Messiah for Joseph in particular. But in this case, Joseph is forcing his brothers to experience the sign of Messiah. So his brothers experience it. Did it fix? Oh, God bless you. Thank you, sir. I'll try to be less aggressive. Gonna snap it again? Got it. Okay, I'll try to be... I'll slow down. Okay, but this is an important idea. This idea of the 3 days to prison for the brothers, and of course Simeon stays there for an unknown period of time as the brothers go back home and get all this association with their father. It's important because this ties into the cup. The cup's important. It means something. So this 3 days in prison is an experience. The brothers had to experience it, even though it's a messianic symbol. Because if they don't experience it, they miss the cup. The cup won't make any sense to us when we're reading the story. We'll read the cup in a minute. We're not there yet. The cup's a big deal in the storyline. So they have to experience 3 days. So they have an experience of what Messiah went through, so to speak, what Joseph went through having prison for 12 years. They have a taste of it. They go through the same exact life that Joseph goes through? No, they don't. But they have the feeling of what it means to be in prison wrongfully. That's an important thing. Wrongfully. Not just in prison for something wrong. No, the justification for sending them in prison is wrong, and they all know it. Why are they sent into prison? Because they're being accused of being spies. Is any of that true? No, not at all. Now we say, well, yeah, but the brother sold Joseph. He's getting back at him, stabbed him, digging a little bit. You deserve it. Look how badly you treated me. That's garbage. The excuse, the reason giving is specifically the spies, which means a false accusation. So they are falsely accused of doing something which they are not guilty of, and yet they are suffering the experience of prison as a result of it. Again, messianic figure. What was Messiah accused of? Falsely accused. And what did he have to endure? He endured the punishment anyway. So we get the taste. The brothers get a flavor of what that life is actually like, and that they have to experience themselves so they understand what a messianic figure is going to be 2,000 years later when he shows up. Okay, now obviously Reuben is pointing out that when he returns, when they come out of the prison. After 3 days, it says you were brought out, the people of these tribes were brought out 3 days later. Of course, what is Joseph's reasoning? It is against the sacrilegious for me to put you in there. It's wrong. It's put all of you in there for all these days. Forever. That is forever, that is. In verse 17 of 42, where is it? Oh, continue 18. Jesus said to them, on the third day, do this and live, because I fear God. If you're truthful people, let one of your brothers be imprisoned in your place in confinement while you go and bring provisions for the hunger of your household. Then bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you will not die. And they did so. So after 3 days, what did the brothers hear Joseph say? I fear God.
Do this and live.
Yep. And live. If you do this. Again, what's the requirement for believing in Messiah? To live? You have to believe. You have to do something and obey his voice. And what do the brothers have to then experience? Now they have a taste of what Messiah goes through from a false accusation. They're brought back out, and the reason is because Messiah, in this case Joseph, fears God, and you will obey this instruction and you will live. So after 3 days, what did the brothers get? Life. Hence, sign of Messiah. 3 days and life. You get to live. They could have left him there in rotten prison for 12 years. Why not? Joseph did. Experience it. Enjoy, guys. Have a party. Not much to enjoy with. But that's the whole point. That's what they get, the sign of Messiah, the 3 days, and they get life. It's an important thing. So they can understand what Messiah means. I'm already out of time, because I'm supposed to go to Hanukkah play later. So look at this thing, a few last details, and then we'll jump to the major point of the tail end of this chapter. So their instruction is to go back, of course, they get back to crap, I don't have time for that. Go back to his family, Reuben obviously tries to coerce or instruct his dad in the tale of the 42 about, you know, I'll take care of Benjamin. I'll bring him down. Put my trust. If something happens, kill my two sons. What kind of offer is that? Seriously. Oh, yeah, I'll kill my grandkids because you didn't bring my son back. Yes. We have an impetuous individual, because what's Reuben known for?
Not only that,
the whole family is that way, exactly. Never the ends. What was that?
Not only that, but Reuben was there when he was supposedly eaten by a wild beast.
This is the interesting part. Reuben doesn't know what's going on. That's the interesting part. Reuben had talked to his brothers in their native language in the presence of Joseph, and Joseph heard it, understood it, but Reuben was saying, it's because of Joseph's blood. Wait a minute. If Reuben was there, he would have known Joseph didn't die. Joseph was sold. Now, we'll read the second parasha section the next time. Judah explaining to Joseph what happened. And Judah conspicuously eliminates the concept of death out of whatever happened to Joseph. Because Judah's the one who sold him. Judah knows what happened. Reuben had told his brothers, send him in the pit. He points out, he thought to himself, I'll get him back and restore him to his dad when the brothers are out of the way and they're not around. That was Reuben's intent. So Reuben's intent was never intended to kill him or anything wrong happened to him at all. But it was Judah's intent to sell the kid instead of having to stick around, or his brothers wanted to kill him. I'm not sure which ones. Who knows? I'm not going to speculate that one. So Reuben, I'm suspecting, probably didn't know Joseph didn't die. He would have found out, because Judah's not going to tell him, oh yeah, hey, buddy, guess what? I sold him. he's not going to volunteer that information. It would not benefit well for Judah. So Reuben may not have known that Joseph was in fact still alive. It just assumed, like everybody else did, that Joseph was killed. Because his blood, there's a coat, he has all this stuff. His father says he's dead. He's just obviously must be dead. Not realizing what had occurred. So Reuben, I think, didn't know. But Reuben already wasn't trustworthy. Why is that? He slept with his father's, well, the mother of like two of his brothers.
Yeah,
what you call it. It's a bizarre relationship. But the mother of his two brothers, he slept with his stepmom. Oh, yeah, that's a big deal. Are you trustworthy? No. But what kind of offer did Reuben give? To take his two sons? That's not an offer worthwhile. Reuben, you're not trustworthy already, and I'm not going to kill my own grandkids because you took my other son is dead. That makes no sense to Jacob at all. Judah's offer was different. Judah's offer said, put him in my hands, and if anything happens to him, I will have sinned against you for all time. And that one, Jacob said, okay. That was a bigger deal that was more acceptable to Jacob than Reuben's offer. Jacob has no knowledge that Judah's the one who sold Joseph to begin with. But Judah knows. And it shows in the story for Judah when he's talking to his dad about this issue that Judah shows he has changed from when he once sold his brother, Joseph, to where he is now. That's a big change to going from get rid of the kid to no, I will stand in his place. I'll protect him with everything I've got. And of course, when he's accused of stealing, he says, take me instead. All of us will be slaves. We're not going to do anything. We belong to you and let him go free. It's better off that happened. Which Judah explains that the next parasha, he gives his oration to Joseph about how really important it is that Benjamin go free and that Judah takes his place. It shows Joseph how far Judah has come when he was sold, whatever it was, you know, almost 15 years earlier, 18 years earlier, when he had sold Joseph. So a long time had happened, and he got to see how Judah had changed. And that was a big deal. Reuben didn't appear to change much. Same guy. He was trying to save Joseph, failed. Trying to save Benjamin here, and Jacob said, uh-uh. you haven't changed much, Reuben. You're not advanced in your age and your knowledge and wisdom. But Judah, Jacob trusts, and Judah, Joseph sees. And Judah winds up explaining to Joseph, and Joseph says, okay, now I get it. You have grown up. You are not the same as you were. When Messiah interviews each one of us individually, what do we want to hear him say?
Well done.
Well done. You've improved. You got the picture. You got the point. I don't smack you to the head anymore. You understand what's going on. That's a big deal. It's an important part we want to understand. So Messiah interviews us. We want to make sure we have good answers. as Judah gave Joseph, or Gizeh gave Joseph good answers. Let's continue on, because I've got the cup. I talked about the cup. That's the whole point of this section. Let's jump to, there's a couple of New Testament verses I'll rattle off to you. Let's jump to 1 Peter. Find 1 Peter, so little. Okay, 1 Peter chapter 2. Now, this I want to relate to you to understand the experience of why the brothers had to understand and experience the 3 days in prison. Why it was important that they experience what it was. Because that was the instruction Messiah gives to all of us. 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. Now wait, was Joseph good and gentle, or was Joseph harsh? Harsh, very harsh. He was a harsh master. This is the instruction, obey your harsh master. For this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. Did the brothers have to suffer wrongfully? Were they truly spies? No. Were they falsely accused? Yes. Were they separate anyway? Yes. 3 days in prison. For what credit is it then when you are beaten for you by your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer for it, you take it patiently is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. So what's Joseph making them experience? His own steps. You're following my steps, house of Jacob. You're following Messiah's steps, house of Jacob. You would experience the thing I experienced, though on a smaller scale. So this idea of prison, which explains the cup, which we'll get to in a minute, was a false accuse for all 10 brothers. They experienced what that means to be in Messiah's, believing in him or following his instruction. The 10 brothers had to follow Joseph in his steps. The 3 days in prison, which and Messiah instructs, you follow me, you follow in my steps, which is you will suffer the experiences I've suffered, wrongfully accused. And what do? Take it patiently. Accept it. It's hard, but accept it. That's the point of it. If we can't do that, are we following Messiah's steps? No, we're not. We can't accept it patiently. We're not following his instruction at all. Let's continue on. In verse 22. Who committed no sin or guile was found in his mouth. Of course, Messiah did obviously not commit sin. And these brothers were not, in fact, spies. Who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to judges righteously. Who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sin, might live for righteousness. By those stripes you were healed. For you were sheep, so you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to shepherd and overseer of your souls. So Joseph experienced his brother, making his brother experience this whole idea of prison, following Joseph's steps, now coming back to Joseph and now following Joseph's instructions. Joseph just became their shepherd. He became their shepherd. My sheep, you'll do this. You're going to go in prison for 3 days. Okay, now you're going to do this. You go get your brother or your father up here, and while this man stays in prison while you're gone. They're following exactly what he says to do. And as a result, what do they get? Well, they get their money back. They get all this food back. All these blessings that get poured upon them. They don't understand why, but they're following in Messiah's steps, and blessings come back upon them. That's the point of it. Because they have to experience what this means. That's where we come into our cup. Let's jump to, okay, so Benjamin and the cup. That's in chapter 44. The instruction course, that after they're leaving, Benjamin gets his blessings of 5 times of food, and we're discussing all the details of their interaction. He gets the money, of course. It gets the mouth, the sack. This is chapter 44, verse 2. My goblet, the silver goblet, placed the mouth of the youngest one's sack along with the money of his purchase, and of course followed Joseph's word exactly. The day dawned, men were sent off, they and the donkeys. They had left the city, gone and not gone far, when Joseph said to one of his households, get up, chase the men, and you overtake them. say then why reap evil for good? Is not the one from which my master drinks, and which he regularly divines, you have done evil how you acted. That's an important idea. Regularly divines. What does it mean? What's the concept of divining? Any ideas? Something regular. The idea of divining is to take what is in heaven, take what is abstract or godly, and bring it down to earth so you can understand it. That's the idea of divination. We can call it prophecy. We can call it a vision. It's the same idea. The idea of taking what is from God and bring it down to what we can comprehend as a simple understanding. So regularly divines. Oh, that was verse, oh, sorry, chapter 44, verse 5, I think it is. Yeah, verse 5, he says that. He rattles out to. That was the instruction that Joseph gives to his servant of how he's supposed to address the ten brothers, or 11 brothers now. All 11 are there. That was chapter 44, verse 5. He repeats it again later on. Let's, of course, he overtakes them, tells what have you done? You said such things. I mentioned earlier, the brothers have no idea that the silver cup is silver or gold. Why would I take silver or gold? It's meaningless to us. He points out that the servant then, he finds their sack. He lowers to the ground. This is verse 12. Search again, the oldest and with the youngest. The goblet was found in Benjamin's sack. They rent his garments, each one reload his donkey, return to the city. They're not going to leave Benjamin alone. That's an important part of this. Let's see what he jumps back down to another part of divination. And see, verse. Oh, there it is. Verse 4:15. What is this deed you have done? Do you not realize that a man like me practices divination? This idea of a divination, this cup. Cup for divination. Divine. This should spring one thought in all of our heads. A single thought. What's one of the many quotes Messiah did, one of the actions he did before he died? He foretold something. He foretold something, and he had something in his hands, bread and wine. And he actually prayed to God before he was captured, God, take this cup from me. He said that multiple times in his prayers. Take the cup from me. Take this away, if it is your will. Of course, it's not his will. Messiah was experiencing the heavenly concept of Messiahhood. He was about to go through a death. It's a difficult cup to accept, a difficult cup to receive or take. This idea of a cup being regularly divine, he's taking this cup, which he uses obviously for drinking wine, because that's what you do. That's what the cups were used for. Don't drink the water. There could be something in there. The wine's safer. You drink wine out of it. It's the divination concept, the divine, take what is heavenly and bring it down earthly. Messiah's death, and he referred to this cup in particular, of course, the flesh also, the bread he says is my flesh, the cup is my blood, the drinking of the blood, the wine, you receive life. Messiah took what was heavenly concepts of life and flesh, brought them down to people that understand at Passover. So we comprehend what Passover is all about. We call it the cup of Messiah and, of course, his bread of being his flesh. We understand that. What the brothers eat while they're at Joseph's house, they ate their meal, which, of course, includes bread. They had bread, they had wine, they receive the cup, they take the cup with them. They don't know it. They take Messiah's cup with them. They take his blood or his life with them. He says, ah, bring it back. That belongs to me. You shouldn't have taken it. The idea of the cup and the bread, the wine, the cup, the divination of the cup, what its function is, and the wine, which, of course, uses the blood or life, I'll write that down. Blood. Life. Because that's the idea of wine. And this cup of divination is bringing what was heavenly down to earthward. So the brothers experienced 3 days in prison. They experienced the bread. And they experienced the wine. They experienced Passover. Before it even existed yet. The brothers experienced this idea. So when we have this cup tied to us, that's the example we're being pointed to. This cup, this divination cup, this idea of Passover cup, which Messiah points out, it's the only time you really use a cup. He's the one who uses it over and over again. There has to be a reason why Joseph did it. It's the idea of bringing what was heavenly down to earthward. So these brothers now experience the Passover service, a miniaturized symbol, a symbolic service. They now understand what Messiah is going to go through. They had to live it. They had to experience it to comprehend it. So now what was now heavenly, this idea of a Passover concept of offering oneself and offering, I'm depending upon Messiah, is now brought to these 12 brothers, sorry, these 11 brothers. They're now going to live and experience it. In this story, that tells us, since they are following in Messiah's footsteps or following Joseph's footsteps, what's Messiah's intent when his brethren, the Jacob's house, come to him? Which is still in our future. They're going to have to experience what Passover is truly about. They're going to experience what suffering truly is. And accept the cup and accept the bread the Messiah gives. So in this symbolism, we have the 10 brothers, which actually now it's 11. It was 10 and 11, because 10 experienced the prison, but 11 experienced the cup and the bread and everything. The 10 and 11, they all experience what we would consider regularly Passover. Those are the symbols of Passover. They're all there. You have the wine, you have the blood, you have the cup that's involved, you have the bread they ate, the meal they shared together, the feast, which you don't eat with Gentiles. As in the instructions, you do not eat my Passover feast with those who are uncircumcised. And what happened at the feast at Joseph's house? They were separated. God made sure every detail was mapped out for the brothers to experience what Passover truly was before it even existed yet. Does that make sense? Now we get the understanding of why God threw the cup in this story. It's an odd object to have. Well, because it completes the picture of a Passover experience to the brothers before Passover even was around. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments about this? Yes.
1,000 years. I think it's in there because I feel like the 1,000 years is in there. The 1,000-year reign, when we go and experience that.
The experience that happens here, it would have to be within that time cycle. So we look at today, we see the Jacob's household, right? They're going to have to come to Messiah at some point in time. Well, at this point in time, Messiah or Joseph is ruler of all the Gentile world, meaning Egypt. And the brothers come to him as their ruler. They bow down to him. So we're going to expect Messiah arrives in our future, whatever day that's going to happen, I don't know yet. When that happens, Jacob's house is going to have to come to him and bow down and what they're going to experience. They're going to have to accept Passover. They're going to accept the fact he died for them. Because that's part of Passover. That's the whole point of it. They have to expect it and experience it to understand what it means. So this whole idea, this picture that the brothers are getting, we're seeing what Messiah's job is during this period of time which he's in charge and he's reigning and trying to dominate the world and there's whole famine. He has all the food, yada, yada, yada. That's the whole process of this of the symbolism that the brothers will experience what everybody who believes in Messiah already does, already has for year after year after year. We keep Passover every year. This is a big deal. This is an important thing that God wanted to make sure everybody understood, and everybody must experience it in its understanding, not just that we got out of Egypt for Moses' time, but Messiah's role in Passover. Yes, David.
Well, it's just amazing, you know, as you look at these things, you know, what they went through at that time and what it symbolized, and yet they didn't truly understand. And then you go to Messiah and how that parallels it to where we are and seeing this with still half a story to be told. And at some point, we'll all be at the end reveling over the beautiful love story.
The story that was there. It's an amazing one.
That it all takes place.
It's an amazing one. This story God intended for everybody to follow and follow through. But this doesn't make a lot of sense yet until you've understood what read through Messiah's life. Then you realize, now I see what's going on. Up to that point, the brothers at this time have no comprehension of what they're doing. They're just following the instructions. But God made sure it was written out for all of us who can read Messiah's life to know what actually happened and see the connection. God was having these brothers experience Passover, what it's like to accept and believe in their Savior, in this case was Joseph, depending upon him and following his instructions and following his footsteps. Yes.
Just a statement, but this implies, and I think Dave was about the same thing, is that we are all going to suffer, including the Jewish people.
Everybody suffers, yes. Well, that's the nature of it. If you don't suffer, did you follow in Messiah's footsteps? No. If you weren't falsely accused, did you follow in Messiah's footsteps? No. It's easy, not easy, it's easier to be accused and you were actually guilty. Like, yeah, it was me, I did it. Versus, I had nothing to do with it. But you just keep it silent, take it silently. That's hard to do. It's not part of human nature. But we all have to suffer. We all have to experience what Passover is truly like, else we miss the picture. We can't relate to him until we understand what he went through. It takes a process for our own lives. Yes, Tammy. Run faster, Jared. Not too fast.
Yeah, you've been using the term House of Jacob, but in a lot of ways, that second time when they returned to Egypt, in some ways, they are more the house of Judah, in a sense, than they are the house of Jacob, even though all the brothers are there.
Right. Judah's the dominant one.
Judah is the leader of it, and you see later on how much of a leader Judah becomes.
Yes.
But even at this point, in some ways, they are the house of Judah, in some ways.
You're absolutely right.
More symbolically than literally, because the other sons are there. But at least symbolically, they are, at this point, house of Judah. So if you think house of Judah, then you think of those Egyptians, you know, on the
Gentiles,
other side.
Right.
They're more like the house of Yosef or the Gentiles. And then you have Messiah, who looks like a Gentile but isn't a Gentile.
Right.
You know, being the Messiah and being the one that both of them...
attached together.
Attached to. And they both understand that he is the leader, he's the ruler, what he says goes.
Right. And that's his house. And that's true. And she's correctly pointing out that in the brothers, who the dominant person is Judah, which we would expect that today. The dominant person, Messiah, shows up. Messiah is reigning. The dominant tribe, which we see, we call them Israel today, but reality is, it's the tribe of Judah. That is the dominant one, the power of most of the household. So he controls it, and that's the one who's going to be expecting to come to him. So I'm way beyond time, and we have a Hanukkah video to do, so we're going to make this quick. Any questions or comments? I missed anything?
That's the way he did that twice.
He did. He could have been hearing back twice. Any other comments or questions? Hopefully it made sense to you. We'll close with a prayer. Mr. Jared, we'll close the prayer.
Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who gave us your Torah. Thank you for letting, thank you for people like Jeff and Daniel to let, and thank you for that that you gave them the wisdom to help us, to help them give us the secrets and pearls of the Torah, God. Thank you for this day. Thank you for Shabbat. And B'Shem Yeshua, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.